talking about people.
Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. Record numbers of voters went to the polls and mailed in ballots for election 2020 to choose our president and other leaders. Joe Biden was leading the vote count all election night. And while stem votes are still being counted, he looks to be the next president of the United States. Our first guest, Harold Meyerson, will join us for election analysis. Following him will be a conversation with Karina Uribe with the Movement Voter Project, who did organizing in Arizona, which helped to turn Arizona from red to blue. So first up is Harold Meyerson, one of the nation's leading political analysts. He's editor-at-large of the American Prospect, one of the top political magazines in the country and my personal favorite. He's also been a weekly op-ed columnist for the Washington Post and executive editor of the LA Weekly, the nation's largest metropolitan weekly. He is here with us today to share his analysis of the 2020 election. Harold Meyerson, welcome back to All Together Now.
Always good to be here, Eleanor.
Always love your analysis. I always learn from you. So appreciate it. Let's start with the big one, the presidency. What's the current state of the race? I know Biden was leading all Tuesday night, but the deal isn't sealed yet. Where do we stand?
I think he will be declared the winner by all of the media outlets that do the declaring, either later today or tomorrow when we have more votes in from Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, and Arizona. I am confident that he will win.
Yeah, it's looking really good. And some people are concerned that this was even close. I mean, a lot of us were hoping to have a complete repudiation of Trump and all the racist, misogynist, greed, et cetera, et cetera. We just wanted to thoroughly renounce everything he stood for. And yet the guy got over 60 million votes and he's made it, you know, we're 2 days in and still counting. What's your sense of why are so many people still backing Trump when he's obviously so awful?
Well, first of all, his campaign clearly did a very good job of turning out his base. And I think most pollsters underestimated the size of his base. Mm-hmm. No one is as yet in a position to assess this, but the Trump people actually walked their precincts for months, while the Biden people, and by which term I mean not just officially his campaign, but almost all of the groups supporting him, largely because of they took the pandemic more seriously than the Trump people, confined their contacts to voters to digital, phone, social media, and so on. The one exception to that that I'm aware of and that I've written about and my magazine has written about beyond just me is the Union of Hotel Workers, which is largely a union of the unemployed, given the fact that, to put it mildly, the hotel industry has not come back yet, who spent months actually walking with not just masks, but face shields in Nevada, Arizona, and Philadelphia, which should ring a bell to our listeners, since those are the places that are going to put Joe Biden over the top very shortly. Finally, you know, we can't underestimate in the larger sense the impact of entities like Fox News and right-wing talk radio hosts who have really been conveying to a lot of America a, you know, Trumpian view of the world for 4 years now. And that has really helped solidify his base. We know from historic examples out of the 1930s and 40s that the big lie told long enough, repeated long enough, works. Trump has always believed that. Fox has always believed that. You know, that is still there. Fortunately, the Fox Newses of this world and Trump himself never convinced anywhere close to a majority of people. And we're going to see the consequence of that tonight, but, or tomorrow. But, and it's a big but, there are a lot of people who disagree not on matters of opinion, but on matters of what they think to be fact. And that is, I think, the ultimate reason why Trump did better than expected in the presidential election.
That's a good analysis. And in spite of that kind of shadow side, actually, it was encouraging to see that Biden won. I mean, all my friends, including me, were like biting our nails in spite of the polls showing 90% chance that Biden's going to win. All my Democratic friends were still nervous and are still nervous, like nail biting. Are they going to take it away from us again this time? And my Republican family, with some Republican friends, were totally confident that Trump was going to win re-election, even though the polls that we knew were showing him like getting smashed. So I think there are some bright lights here. If you look at some of the swing states that Biden did win, and let's talk first about the industrial Midwest. I know Hillary Clinton had lost Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, but Biden has won, it looks like, Michigan and Wisconsin, and possibly even Pennsylvania, although that's uncertain. What do you see happening with kind of the industrial Midwest vote?
Well, there are two shifts in voting that I think explain why Biden took Michigan and Wisconsin, and I think will certainly take Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Shift one was, even in the broader sense, in that case, there are three reasons. Reason one is that Biden actually paid attention to those states, whereas the Clinton campaign notoriously did not. As most listeners know, she never actually managed to visit Wisconsin, which in hindsight was one hell of a mistake. So the mega lesson coming out of 2016 is no, those are not states you take for granted just because they had been a blue wall. We learned from 2016 that that wall can be breached. And so the Biden campaign and, you know, the organizations supporting Biden independently learned that lesson and made a big emphasis on it. But in particular, two things. One, they really worked African-American turnout, which is much higher in the major cities of those three states, respectively, Milwaukee, Detroit, and Philadelphia, which we're going to hear from, I think, tonight or tomorrow, greatly boosting turnout in those cities. The second thing is there was, after 4 years of Trump, enough dismay about Trump among, you know, moderate Republicans, relatively moderate Republicans, mm-hmm. to the extent, you know, and voters who at least has historically been Republicans, that Biden did better than Clinton in the suburbs surrounding those three cities, which historically have been Republican. And that made a big difference too. And the Biden campaign certainly did major outreach and major appeals to those areas. So that, I think, accounts for the difference there in the industrial or semi-post-industrial Midwest.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And the other kind of bright light here, at least in the medium term, if not for this election, is in the South. I was shocked to see some of the polls showing that the Democrats could win, you know, in North Carolina, even South Carolina, and Texas was showing to be neck and neck. You know, as it turned out, when we actually got the vote, different story. Or Georgia was another one that looked like it might be in play. But even though Trump has won most of those and is leading still in Georgia and North Carolina, there's an outside chance Biden could take Georgia.
I don't think it's outside. I think Biden will take Georgia.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
That's encouraging.
And now they've already, you know, the Senate race for David Perdue, Senate seat, he's now, I think, just fallen under 50%. So that will go to a runoff in January, as will the other Senate seat, which is the Democrats' Hail Mary chance to take the Senate and the January 5th runoffs that will take place in Georgia. I think Georgia and Arizona long-term are the most interesting results because these are historically solid Republican states, states where the white majority always voted for the conservative side. Arizona, historically, you know, the Goldwater movement incubated there with Barry Goldwater, which then became the Reagan movement. But there has been such demographic change in both states as minority populations have come to comprise a greater share of the state and of the electorate, and as the share of college-educated whites has risen dramatically in both states, that you're getting metro areas that dominate each state, Phoenix in Arizona, Atlanta in Georgia, that are beginning to look, substantially like northern metro areas in terms of their political slant. And that is huge. And that is pushing both of those states, I think, into the blue column this year. And still, will eventually, have real consequences in North Carolina and Texas.
That's very encouraging. I know since 2008, when Obama first ran, we've been hearing about the rising American electorate, where, you know, the young people of color coming along would be more progressive, and the older, more conservative Republican voters would literally be dying off. But, you know, here we are 12 years later, and it's still a nail biter in terms of this election. But from what you're saying, it sounds like you believe that trend is happening, and probably even as soon as the next presidential election, with Georgia going blue, Texas maybe heading blue, that it should be easier for a Democrat to win if we have a great candidate.
Yeah. I remember in 2002, shortly after I began editing The American Prospect, we ran an excerpt from a new book by John Judas and Rui Teixeira entitled The Emerging Democratic Majority. And over the years, I've amended that to say, well, the slowly emerging Democratic majority.
Right.
But as one of the Prospect's board members, Stan Greenberg, continually asserts, he's the one who coined the phrase the rising American electorate. It is emerging. Now, it's not emerging quite in the way some of us expected. I think one of the cautionary notes about this from the election is the Latino vote, which is very progressive in California, very progressive in New York, substantially, but not all that very progressive, still in Nevada and Arizona, but enough to make a difference. And clearly not in Florida, which is a different population. I mean, there are other factors in Florida too. A lot of the more conservative whites from the Midwest, when they retire, move to the west coast of Florida. And so, it's a state whose own rising electorate is, chronologically different from that in other states, as is the case with any state to which retirees flock. But clearly Florida is in a class by itself. I mean, it may be that the long-term lasting effect of Fidel Castro is to keep Florida in the Republican column for
wouldn't that be ironic?
Than it otherwise would be. So go figure.
Right, exactly. And Donna Shalala down there, the woman in Congress who was running for re-election, had been the former head of, cabinet member under President Bill Clinton, lost her seat this time to an Hispanic woman. So a Hispanic Republican woman. Yeah. So it's definitely very different complexion of the Hispanic vote, depending on where you're looking. What about the gender gap? And I mean by that both the women and the men, because we've been kind of had women voting for Democratic candidates in larger numbers for many years now, but the men have tended to be going Republican, in majority men Republican, and we need to know like how many of the women can we make up with on that. So what do you see happening with the gender gap in this presidential race?
It's still there. What fascinated me most was I was looking at exit polling, and on the Edison exit poll, which is the one on which most of the networks rely, the gender gap among whites was actually pretty small. It was actually just about 3%, but among Latinos and African Americans, it was about 10%, which has to give you pause, to put it mildly. We know in general that blue collar men tend to be more conservative than white collar men, and we know for reasons of discrimination that Latino and African American men are disproportionately more blue collar than white men, and maybe that helps explain it. There might be other explanations as well, but the gender gap is still with us, and I think in the case of the Latino vote, I think it was clearly a factor in the relative unexpectedly high, about one third of the Latino vote that went to Donald Trump.
Right, and I was looking at some of the data in the swing states. The gender gap, particularly around women, actually varied a lot. Like some states, it would be maybe 5%, but I think in the state of Virginia, for example, it was 20%. And broke heavily for Joe Biden and the Democrats. So there may be some regional variance that gender gap data also. So what about seniors? Now, there's another one. I was excited before the election to hear some of the polls showing seniors in Florida were going for Biden and the Democrats. But then when I look at the data of the exit polls, it's showing that seniors actually voted Republican again. So what do you see happening with seniors in this race?
Well, it's a mixed bag. Biden did better among seniors than Clinton did, I think. But seniors, like everyone else, can be appealed to on cultural grounds, for lack of a better term, as well as the way in which Biden made his appeal, which was largely along the lines of who do you trust to deal with the pandemic, for which seniors have a higher death rate than any other age group. But, if you're attached to an earlier version of what America looks like and should look like, the older you get, the more the America you reference is a white America of earlier times, which you may well see through rose-colored glasses. So that makes it a pink America, I guess. But I think that has a real effect, and I think that was one reason why Trump did better with seniors than a lot of the polling had suggested he would.
Very interesting. Let's move on to the U.S. Senate, where, again, we were hoping to have a clear Democratic majority. Several of the races that we thought were going to be close or would go Democrat actually ended up staying Republican, and it's still unclear kind of who's going to have the majority. What happened in the Senate races?
Well, it wasn't a pretty picture. And here I would argue that, you know, that's where the polling really led us astray, because we were thinking Democrats would pick up Iowa. We were thinking mm-hmm. Democrats would pick up North Carolina. We had an outside hope, but South Carolina maybe, and maybe even Kansas. Well, as my friend Ron Brownstein, who writes for The Atlantic, has continually pointed out, when senatorial elections occur in the same year as presidential elections, there's almost no ticket splitting. If you look at the performance of senators, it about equals that of the presidential candidate of their own party. And underestimating how well Trump would do in states like Iowa, North Carolina, Kansas, Texas, et cetera, we underestimated how that the Republicans would win all those states, not to mention states that we never really previously had thought would be close, like South Carolina and Kentucky, for God's sake. So there was a lot of misplaced expectation. Now, there was one and only one exception to this rule, and that was Maine and Susan Collins, a state that Joe Biden won by, I don't know, 11, 12 points, but where Susan Collins won 50% or a little more than 50% of the vote and was reelected, which kind of breaks that mm-hmm. general phenomenon and that general rule, with one possible caveat, though, which is she never actually said she was going to vote for Donald Trump. She never actually said she was going to vote against Donald Trump either. She just clammed
up. Dodged it.
Yeah, which appeared, in hindsight, appeared to be the right strategy for her. And Maine, you know, the two states in the northern corners of the United States, Maine and Alaska, are each really weird. that's a political science term. They're really weird. And that was shown, I think, in this election. But otherwise, by overestimating Trump's performance, the Democrats way overestimated their senatorial candidate's performance. But that, though, finally brings us to Georgia. Georgia has peculiar election laws. In statewide elections, if no candidate gets 50% on the first Tuesday of November, they go to a runoff in early January. And for a variety of complicated reasons, both Senate seats are up in Georgia. And it now looks like both will go to a runoff. If the Democrats manage to win both, they would get to 50. And with Kamala Harris as vice president breaking the tie, that would give them a Senate majority. That's going to be kind of a stretch. But the only thing it really guarantees is that, as the old song says, Georgia will be on our minds between now and January 5th, which is the date of the runoff elections there.
Right. And we want to also point out we did have two Democratic pickups in the Senate. In Arizona, the astronaut and gun safety advocate Mark Kelly took over that Republican Senate seat from Martha McSally. And also in Colorado, we had Hickenlooper took the Senate seat away from the Republican there. So we did get two pickups, but, you know, like you say, we have to get to that 50 vote mark, and we're going to need those two Senate seats in Georgia in the runoff in January to actually get there.
Yeah. And the Democrats lost the seat in Alabama, which everyone expected. It was kind of a fluke that Doug Jones had been elected in Arizona in a special election against a guy who was almost a child molester, as it were. And hung on by a very narrow margin in Michigan. So that that brings the Democratic total to 48, and we will have to wait on Georgia to see what happens there.
Right. And let's talk about the U.S. House now. I looked yesterday, and it looked like the Republicans had a gain of 5 seats in the House, but the Democrats will still maintain the majority, so Nancy Pelosi will stay on as Speaker. But what happened in the House races?
I think that's best described by the word blindsided. I don't think anyone was expecting the Democrats to lose seats. They lost some of the seats that they kind of improbably won in 2018, the one in South Carolina around Charleston, I think the one in Oklahoma City, not historically Democratic terrain. Cities are clearly where Democrats do better, so it looked like we had the city exception, excuse me, in both places. But when the Trump people really turn out, that city exception wasn't quite enough. I don't remember a single warning shot coming across the Democrats' bow on this, at least, not publicly, and based on the failure of Democrats to rush to any House member, endangered House members' rescue, probably not privately either. I think this just shows the resilience of the Trump vote when you get outside usual Democratic terrain.
Right. I was surprised to see the Republican pickup. I went, wait a minute, what happened to our blue wave? So much for the polls. I think this may be the end of polling as we knew it. Like, nobody's going to believe them. Between 2016 and 2020, they were so far off the mark. I mean, they're almost useless at this point.
I was just before the broadcast, I was writing a mea culpa about my falling for them.
We used to think it was scientific, and we were relying on data to make judgments, and we just can't rely on that data anymore.
That would seem to be the case, yes.
And just quickly before we sign off, I know you're busy, but have you tracked the state legislatures? We were wanting to get more Democratic control in more of the states because they're going to do the redistricting based on the 2020 census. So what happened in the state? Did any of them shift party?
Apparently the only one that shifted party was Arizona. And that's ironic because Arizona legislature doesn't do redistricting. It's a nonpartisan commission that does redistricting. So since the larger point of taking over the legislatures was to affect the decennial redistricting after we get the new census, it was a complete flop. And, the election was held in the existing districts. And where the existing districts had been a Trump stronghold, those that were Trump strongholds remained Trump strongholds, and the Democrats really failed to make any significant progress with state legislatures.
Right. And speaking of Trump again, he's making all these lawsuits. He's making a lot of noises. He's trying to discredit the results as he has been trying for months now. Do you think it's a lot of sound and fury that'll signify nothing, or is this going to be a very rocky transition?
I think legally it signifies nothing. I don't think this has even the minimal plausibility to get Trump-appointed judges to go along with it. Politically, it's significant because, I watched Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity last night to see what they would say, and they were basically saying this election is illegitimate, it's a seizure of power, and so on. And so the people who go down the line with Trump are gonna be thinking that, and that is an unhappy condition for the United States to be in.
Yeah, and combined with the Republicans having continued control in the Senate, that's gonna make life difficult once Biden is inaugurated. He's going to have to get his cabinet appointments approved through the Senate, any judicial appointments through the Senate, any legislation through the Senate. We still got Mitch McConnell and the Republicans who had just been so obstinate to any Democratic initiatives from Obama on. So any words of advice to the Biden administration?
Yes. Let me make an appeal here. Almost a year ago, actually a little over a year ago, my magazine, The American Prospect, did something called the Day One Agenda, listing about 30 things that a Democratic president, and a year ago, September, we had no idea who that would be, that a Democratic president could do by executive order or policy change without having to get Congress to change anything. Well, unhappily, we're probably going to be in that situation. But it turns out, among the things we have written about, that the president can get rid of a lot of student debt, that the president can reduce drug prices, that the president can allow cheap drug imports from Canada, that the president can recreate postal banking as opposed to people having to bank in conventional banks, so on and so on. So I would urge people to go to my magazine's website, www.prospect.org, type in Day One Agenda, and you will have a menu of things that a President Biden can do, even if the Republicans control the Senate.
Fantastic. And that's all the time we have. It always flies by with you. Harold Meyerson, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your really great analysis.
Thank you, Eleanor, and good luck to us all.
Yes. Our next guest is Karina Arrive, Arizona State Advisor with the Movement Voter Project. Karina is a graduate from Arizona State University. She often shares her personal story of navigating the education system as an undocumented DACA student because her journey to finish college led her to the world of community activism and organizing. In 2016, she was part of the historic effort to get Sheriff Jeff Arpaio out of office, which succeeded. So thank you very much for that great work. And this year, Karina's been working in Arizona and is one of the reasons why we have shifted Arizona from red to blue. So welcome, Karina Arrive.
Hi, thank you for having me, Eleanor.
So I just first saw you yesterday listening to the great summary of the work from the Movement Voter Project that you and your colleagues have been doing. And I was just so grateful to all of you, like young, strong people out there really working, doing the organizing that it takes to win elections. So for our listeners who haven't heard of it, can you describe what is the Movement Voter Project?
Now, the Movement Voter Project is a national organization that helps build and support existing grassroots organizations on the ground across the country to build long-term power during the election, to win elections, and in the off seasons to continue to flex that muscle. So we are, in the 2020 cycle, we focused on the five presidential swing states, which Arizona, as we know, was one of them. And I am the Arizona State Advisor and live in Arizona. I've been here for last 20 years. And that was my primary focus with the Movement Voter Project, was to help support over 26 local organizations on the ground that were primarily people of color-led, immigrant-led, women-led, LGBTQ-led groups that do year-round organizing around issues that matter the most to their communities, but also do very important work to get out, to register and get out people to vote during election cycles.
Fantastic. Well, you've done just wonderful work, and I really appreciate it. And can you tell us a little bit what happened in Arizona? I mean, it's an important state for two reasons. One, it was a presidential swing state. It's turned out to be actually very pivotal in selecting the next president. And also we had the key U.S. Senate race there with Mark Kelly, the Democrat and the astronaut running for the U.S. Senate. So tell us what happened in Arizona on Tuesday night, election night.
Yeah, I mean, this was an election that a night like many other folks across the country we had been planning for and working for since 2016, right? Since the last announcement of the presidential race in 2016. And, you know, groups across the state had been gearing up in 2020. We were ready to hit the doors, hit the phones, talk to voters. And, you know, then there was COVID changed a lot of our initial planning. It changed a lot of the initial strategy, but we were able to overcome the obstacles faced with because of the pandemic. And we were still able to reach out to voters, talk to millions of over 2 million voters, register over 180,000 new voters. And what happened on Tuesday is that we finally were able to shift a very red state, which became purple in 2018 because of the same efforts from the same groups, to a blue state. And we flipped on the presidential. So our state went to Biden. And then we also won the very important Senate race. We now have two Democratic senators in our state. And we were also able to pick up, or are in the process of picking up, some very important state House and state Senate seats. So we are in the last cycle in 2018, which was a very important cycle for us, which solidified us as being more of a purple state. We picked up a lot of seats then in the midterm, but now we are only two seats away from flipping the state House. So it's likely that those races won't be called until the end of the week, but they are many of them are very close. And we are waiting for those efforts to pay off. And then we won at every level of up and down the ballot. We won county attorney races, one very important one here in Maricopa. We're waiting in Pima. So across the board, we saw great wins, especially when it came to education. We passed Prop 208, which is the ballot initiative that was put on the ballot by the people for increase in education funding.
Fantastic. And I know education is so important, you know, for so many people, and it's near and dear to your heart. And talk a little bit about like what education has meant for you personally in your own life.
Yeah, definitely. And before I say that, I think one thing that I'll add about what happened Tuesday is that the efforts of all of the organizing that's been happening here for the last, not just 4 years, but 10 years paid off. And we really saw the fruits of the labor of grassroots organizing that was led by people of color, what we truly saw on Tuesday night. Yes, education to me has been life-changing. I think it's really something that has made its mark and has been a big part of my story and my trajectory. I came into organizing because I was seeking more equitable education, access, and opportunities. Before DACA, I was paying out-of-state tuition in the state of Arizona because of a proposition called Prop 300, which bars undocumented students from receiving financial aid. And a lot of my advocacy started around education access and equity here in the state. So that is a fight that I fully support, both giving more access to as many people as possible in order for them to be able to be successful in education and contribute, but also to really reward our educators who are really also should be considered frontline workers, right? They're out there educating the next generation of leaders, the next generation of citizens. So we need to make sure that they are being compensated for their work.
Right. Very well said. Well, the education can be a doorway to a better life for so many people. And it worked for me. It's working for you, and want to open that door to as many people as possible. So good for you for doing that. So back to turning Arizona from red to purple to blue. you had some great successes.
Can you please get him? I'm sorry.
That's okay. You've got a child. I've got a cat. So some of the great successes that bore fruit on Tuesday night, as you said, were kind of a long time in the making. So who were some of the people that were behind that organizing that really made that shift possible?
Yeah, so yesterday I explained that every time I talk about how we came to this moment, even a few months ago or weeks ago before the election, as I would talk about my projections, was that we needed to understand the history of the state and the movement to understand the moment that we're currently in. And I think, you know, for decades, obviously, we've had amazing organizers, but a turning point specifically in how we got from red to blue was back in 2010. There was an anti-immigrant bill that was passed here in the state, SB 1070, which is the Show Me Your Papers law, for those of you who don't know, which basically turned police into immigration authorities and allowed them the jurisdiction to ask people for their immigration status and documentation and to pull people over for anything that they believe to be probable cause that they may be here, quote unquote, illegally. And we know that that was an awful policy, an awful law. And it really sparked, you know, a lot of fear in the immigrant community. We're a border state here. We have a lot of immigrant folks, but we also have, you know, a lot of second, third generation immigrant folks, Latinx community, people of color that were going to be targeted by this law, which was a very blatant racist law, and a racial profile would lead to racial profiling. And this law was really passed in an effort by the state legislature to force an exodus of immigrants out of the country. Mm-hmm. And aside from doing all of these, sparking this fear and this outrage and all of this, you know, at that moment, there was something else that happened too, which was our local leaders at that time, who were very young, some who are still in the movement now, 10 years ago, had a choice to make. And that choice was to either succumb to that fear and to the attacks that the legislature was putting upon us, or to like stand up and fight. And that's what, that was the path that was chosen, to stand up and fight against this horrible policy. And many leaders came together and in unison to do something about this. And within a year, the author of that bill was recalled out of his position in office by these young leaders. They formed a coalition, put a campaign together, and recalled him. And the trajectory just kept going cycle after cycle. These leaders kept growing and learning and working together, not only educating and advocating for against awful bills and for bills that were for the community, but also registering and turning out people to vote cycle after cycle. We got rid of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. We got rid of Pierce, who wrote SB 1070. We also passed amazing policy that would benefit the citizens of the state, like Prop 206, which increased the minimum wage. So there was all of these things, and all the common denominator of all of these campaigns is that they have been led by local grassroots organizations like Mi Familia Vota, Lucha Arizona, Poder in Action, just to name a few. And these are all organizations that come from the community. They're led by young people of color, by women, by immigrant folks, by indigenous people. And the reason that these folks have been successful is because they are best equipped to talk to the voters that they are trying to turn out, which are also, you know, young people of color, immigrant folks, indigenous people, because that base is really representative of the majority here in the state. And we want our elected officials and the policy that we are pushing for to be representative of our values and what's important to us. So in 2018, we picked up a lot of seats, had a lot of victories, like I mentioned, went from red to purple. And this year we were ready to bring it home and to do the full blue flip, and we did it.
Fantastic. So this has been like a 10-year odyssey of organizing. And from that 2020 horrendous, I felt a little bit when that was passed, was like, oh my God, this is America. That sounds more like what South Africa did with the blacks. So like, show me your papers. But I'm so glad that got overturned and was kind of a spark to make a lot of changes, get Sheriff Joe out of there and many other changes. You personally, like, how many years have you been organizing now in Arizona? Did you get in around the Sheriff Ipeo?
So I started in 2010, and that was the SB 1070 fire. I started volunteering, coming out to marches, and then was engaged by some of these groups and started developing my different skills. The first campaign I did was actually a voter registration campaign. In the 2014 midterm, and that was a nonpartisan campaign where I talked to voters about the importance of voting for candidates that supported Dreamers. And that was really my first experience of talking to voters one-on-one. It was a very small campaign, but I learned a lot. And then in 2016, I worked on the Basta Arpaio campaign, which was, you know, a community effort by Poder in Action, Lucha Arizona, and a few other folks that came together to get rid of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. And it was an amazing feeling when that happened in 2016. And we were successful in doing that.
Fantastic. And so talk a little bit about your role this year in the election. You're the state advisor in Arizona for the Movement Voter Project. What does that mean to be state advisor? Were you helping to coordinate all the local grassroots groups, or what was your role?
Mm-hmm. So like I mentioned, the Movement Voter Project is a national organization, and specifically our role this year was to help, like you mentioned, coordinate some of the efforts if there was need to do that. I've been lucky to work in a state where there's already a lot of coordination and groups. You know, that's why we've been successful. Groups have been able to come together and build statewide plans that allow us to maximize our efforts when we're reaching out to talk to voters. But my job was also to make sure that groups had all of the resources that they needed so that they had adequate trainings for get out the vote efforts, that they had adequate access and trainings on tools, especially in a year where I mentioned that field efforts to reached out to voters would look different because of some of the usual tactics were delayed because of the pandemic. So we relied a lot on technology, and part of my job was making sure that the organizations all had access to these tools and were trained on these tools, and that they also had adequate funding to pay staff to have access to these tools, to run their field programs. So part of the work that MVP does is fundraise so that we can move, a big part of what we do is move resources to these groups so that they can worry about what's important, which is talking to voters, talking about the issues, and making sure that we can protect our democracy.
Right. And you've been successful not only in the organizing, but on the fundraising also. Tell our listeners, like, how much money did Movement Voter Project raise this year for this 2020 election?
It was over $100 million that was moved directly to groups in the cycle, which is amazing. And, everything that we raise goes directly to our partners. And it makes the world of a difference, especially, you know, since 2016, we saw a lot of new organizing that started to be galvanized because of Trump's election. And it's just even more so now as we got closer to the election. In the last 2 years, there has been a lot of added groups to the infrastructure. So for example, here in Arizona, this year there were, or in the last 2 years, there's been a lot of new Black-led organizing, Indigenous-led organizing that we wanted to support. So being able to give them their first grant and continued support just means the world to these organizations and is able to really move their work forward in a way that otherwise they wouldn't be able to do.
That's impressive. $100 million it's a lot of money to be moving. It's a major factor. And over how many states was that $100 million spent?
We fund, I think, over 20 states. Again, a majority of the funding went to our, what we call tier one and tier two states, or tier ones this year were our presidential and Senate states, including Pennsylvania, Arizona, Florida, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And then we had some tier two states, including Georgia. And a lot of the funding really went there, which you can see is paying off. We were able to flip Arizona. We are on the, I think we've already had Wisconsin called in Michigan. I'm not sure. Yes. And then we're waiting on Georgia. So, you know, we really moved resources in the states that we knew were going to be pivotal this year. And we wanted to make sure we did everything that we could to ensure that groups had resources to talk to as many voters as possible.
That's fantastic. So what's your favorite story? You're obviously working with a lot of local organizing groups within Arizona, mostly young people, mostly people of color. What's your favorite experience that kind of gives a good illustration of what it was like working in Arizona this year for the election?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many. To me, my favorite part, I think my favorite all over the end of this year, you know, a lot of the election was done remotely, which I think was like, was different. And maybe a little disappointing for people because we were ready and then the pandemic came and it was like, oh, it was a little deflating at the beginning of the year, trying to figure out our footing. But just to see that, just to see how resilient folks were and how innovative folks were. Actually, in March, I went out, was it March, April, May, I don't know, a few months ago, I went out with a crew that came down to film our Arizona video for MVP, which you can find on our website. And I got to travel all across the state. I went to Navajo Nation. Wow. And yeah, I was there. I traveled up to Navajo Nation for a few days with a video crew. And there's an organization called Diné Care. They are the Diné people native to Arizona, Navajo. And I got to be with them for, I think, 3 days. And I had already learned a lot about their organizing. We support them. But to be there in person in their community, they took us up to a generating station, which they'd been fighting against for years, that they were successful in closing down through their advocacy. And it was just amazing to be in a part of Arizona. And I'd lived here for so long and I'd never been there before. So to be there and then to hear about, you know, Navajo Nation was impacted greatly by the pandemic disproportionately to other parts of the country. And to see that they were still, they were still ready to fight and to continue to fight during this election, despite of everything that was happening, it was really, I'm getting the chills right now. It was really moving, and really reminded me of why I do this work.
That's fantastic. And what do you think? You know, you've been so successful in Arizona over these 10 years. What do you think are the lessons we can learn from Arizona that might help us in other states?
I think that the number one thing is investment in POC-led groups, and POC means people of color. Investment in these grassroots groups, LGBTQ, women-led, immigrant-led groups, so that those groups can continue to grow their leadership, can continue to grow their organizations and can continue to grow their base so that they can empower others, they can empower their neighbors, people in their community to get involved and to come out and vote. This is how we are going to be able to replicate what's happened in Arizona across the country. Supporting these groups financially, number one investment, but also supporting them with your volunteer hours and time if you have it. Overall investment of the entire ecosystem of an organization is what's needed. And then also investing in the overall ecosystem of the state. So working together, like what we've seen here in Arizona, it's not only one organization doing the work, it's multiple doing their part and then working together to see the results that we've been able to see.
Right. And what can our listeners do? I mean, we can't all live in Arizona or even in a swing state. But what can our listeners do to help make change in our home states, wherever we may live?
Yeah, regardless if you live in a swing state or not, there's always different opportunities for you to create change at a local level. So I think some of the biggest fights and best victories are made at the local level of school boards, city council races, state legislatures. All of those things, or even if we're not talking about elected positions, if we're talking about advocating for issues, right? Mm-hmm. There's always something you can do. So I would encourage you to join an organization, find a community of like-minded people and be an ally and go out there and find how you can get involved. You know, if you're busy or if you have a lot going on, another way that you can support is to give some of your money to one of these organizations and help seed the investment. That's just as important. We understand that everybody has a role to play, and that's also something that's greatly appreciated, is being able to give that that monetary support so that these organizations can run cycle in and cycle out.
Right. Well, I encourage our listeners to check out your group, the Movement Voter Project, and I'm impressed with the way you work and the way you treat each other so respectfully and sensitively. And I think, you know, it gives me great hope for the country to know that you and your colleagues. Thank you so much for all
thank
the great
so
work
that you
do.
Thank you so much for having me today. It was a pleasure.
Karina Uribe with the Movement Voter Project. That's all the time we have. Thanks so much and hope to have you back sometime.
Look forward to it.